In this segment of our special six-hour broadcast on the anniversary, 10th anniversary of the Christopher Street Rebellion, we're going to cover an aspect of the gay movement that is something that is in the very now. It's not 10 years ago anymore. Suddenly it's right now, and one of the most exciting things that's going on in the movement is the involvement of and inclusion of various segments within the gay community that have not been involved in what we call the movement heretofore. We're talking about the black experience and the brown experience, third world people in general. And we have with us in the studio, we have Larry Bonneries, who is the vice president of Gay Political Caucus and is on the executive committee of the board of National Gay Task Force. And we have with us also Dr. Charles Law, who is with Texas Southern University here in Houston and is kind of one of the founding members of the Houston Committee and the past president of that organization. He was also one of the co-executive directors of Houston Town Meeting. Charles and Larry, welcome to Wallenstein. What's going on? Are third people really getting involved in the movement, or is that so much icing?
Well, why don't Larry give his
perspective? Come on, Larry.
Well, I would say that their raw input is a necessary input. And at this time, it's gaining much more momentum than before because third world people have come out of that closet of that identity of color and moving into their identity of dealing with the discrimination in sexual appetites. This enhances the movement in that young people growing up in the barrios and the ghettos can see positive images, whether male or female, in the movement itself in leadership positions, thereby give them an opportunity to feel good about themselves after having dealt with their blackness or brownness.
Well, we're talking about, you know, like in the last year, we have seen third world people get involved. And prior to that, the movement was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males.
I don't think the movement had any room before now for that type of input. Nor were third world people as ready as they are today. Because you have to remember, back in the 60s, we were just still fighting Jim Crow. We were still fighting laws of discrimination that were based on color. Now the country has changed in attitudes, and we're fighting a different type of discrimination today.
Charles, what do you think about the getting involved of third world people? Why has it been so slow?
Well, I think maybe some definition for clarity. When we talk about the movement, I think we're talking about what can actually be codified as an organized effort to bring about the rights and the dignity of gay people. In that sense, the movement, I tend to see from my perspective, and perhaps with a little more professional, that bourgeois group of black gays, a rather slow and maybe cautious involvement on their part. And so far as the gay communities, as they have been, there's been black involvement for years before there could actually have been said there was a movement. There were black people who were present in the communities in various and sundry manners, either in the other white bars after the black movement itself, in other small black gay bars and so forth. But I think there's a couple of considerations that I tend to observe. One is the fact that the fear that a lot of black people have about disclosure, whether they're being homosexual in a larger sense of being identified with the movement, which I think a lot of people tend to identify being involved with the movement means coming out of the closet and being identified as a gay person, even as someone who is gay or someone who is supportive of gay people. Secondly, I think that black people, with that fear, they sort of justify the lack of involvement by saying, well, we're still dealing with the problems of being black.
You think that's an excuse rather than a reason?
It's an excuse because for black people now to say we're dealing with the problems of being black, there's really no dealing with that because there is no black movement anymore. The death of Dr. King, in a sense, represented a death of the black movement. There is no leadership, there's no platform, there's no forum to which black people can address themselves, where any answers or reasonable solutions can be approached. There are various individuals somewhat spurted around. There's still Jesse Jackson, there's still Coretta King, there's still Ralph Abernathy, there's still the guy with the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
those individuals are there, but nothing significant is happening. And I think that if anyone would really go back and trace it, no significant changes have really occurred. No legislation, no efforts, no moves, other than the somewhat accommodating, benevolent position of the white society in terms of following the tenets of the Civil Rights Act.
1964, 1967.
It still has not become law. It's only an act. And they're resting on that particular thing. And I think that it is important for black people to realize that black people in this country have problems. There is no addressment for that. And I somewhat describe it as them being caught in a Jeremiad existence, somewhat lost in a wilderness, meandering along. But as gay people, they also have problems of discrimination, as they have the problems of being black.
And something is happening in the gay movement.
True. So if you're black and you're gay, then you have a double factor. You're sort of caught in double jeopardy there.
Whereas we also have to give black people a chance. In other words, from the standpoint of seeing an individual removed from a society and not given any freedoms, and over a 10-year period, being advanced in freedoms, being able to catch up educationally, being able to be given a better education or an opportunity for an equal education, then being given these job opportunities, you have to give a chance for catch up, a chance for that education level and a job opportunity to equal itself. So I see not only black gays, but black people in general and browns at the same time taking these 10 years as a chance for adjustment, a chance to adjust, to meet up with the standards that are necessary to fill these job qualifications.
Well, apparently both of you are persons who have gotten involved in leadership roles in the community. Was that a struggle? I mean, was there any, did you find any racism among the sacred white leaders of the gay movement?
I didn't find a struggle. I think, at least not for necessarily the sacred white leaders. I think those, I don't know how I was being viewed by them. Maybe I was maybe the great black hope.
to coin a phrase.
Or something. I found more resistance from black people, from those in the movement. Because if you come out, if you are identified as a leader, and I don't necessarily consider myself as a leader, but if you're identified with that and associated, then their fear comes over their association with you will then couple your association with a movement, and people will say, oh, well, then they must be gay.
Second generation paranoid.
You know, so you are suddenly within the black community, in some sense, you become like Naaman, you have leprosy,
mm-hmm.
and people are telling you to go to the pool and wash.
And a lot of gay people, black gay people, are telling
black gay people.
I'm just the opposite.
You go from both sides. You have black constituency and a
right.
brown constituency.
Black and brown constituency. Being Creole and growing up in a community where I could, what you call, quote, pass and assimilate and sit there and listen to the white man's tongue in cheek. As far as that remark you made earlier, Charles, about being accepted in the struggle itself, you probably wore to white society the great gift to the movement because you wore visibly black. But me not being visibly black nor brown, etc., being able to assimilate into their world, it was a bother. It was a threat to their power establishment, because the way it had been set up in the past was one leader or two leaders or three leaders. And I can't see the gay movement accomplishing anything unless they broaden that leadership. I can affect so many changes, so can many of the other leaders, but there are a hell of a lot of leaders out there within the mainstream of the gay community that need to come forth. I can't speak for women. Therefore, we need to have a woman to speak for women's issues. We need to have a Chicano. We need to have a black. We need to have a drag queen. We need to have a biker. We need to have an old dyke. We need to have everyone that's willing to come forth so we can show the diversity of the gay community. And in that diversity, this is where I find that the gay community has its strength. Because if society in general could see what the gay experience is, which is a look into humanity and its diversities and an ability to want to learn and celebrate those diversities. And from that, we become one in humanity. So in dealing with the leadership, I found it a threat to them, my personage, a threat to them, both during town meeting and even after, in running for vice president of gay political caucus and in seeking a position with the National Gay Task Force.
You seem to have overcome whatever adversary effect there was, because you've got a nice string of titles and a long history of performance.
Well, mainly because I've dealt with this my entire life. I mean, as I said earlier, in being Creole, being between a black and a white community, where I had to fit into my own community, I learned to deal with blacks as well as whites and learned to realize that we all have something in common. So when I deal with people, I don't deal with them from the side of what we have that are not in common. I deal with them from the fact that what we have that are in common, let's learn to learn one another, and then after that, deal with the points we disagree upon.
Well, let me ask a question here, because I've got one. Or do you have one particularly pertinent to that?
Well, I think more of a statement in terms of what Larry was saying, and I think it's very pointed, as I observe. I think Larry and I perhaps represent a standard, but then somewhat unique coupling about black people. See, whereas you're white, someone who's white, anybody who's white is white, and they all accept them as being white. Whereas with black people, because of miscegenation, they have their discriminations within themselves. Someone who is very fair-skinned and is passing, such as Larry, is black, but not only receiving discrimination from white people outside of his ethnic identity, he is also receiving discrimination from black people within his ethnic identity.
But not necessarily passing per se, being assumed to be passing.
Well, I've always assumed, and maybe I'm mistaken, but that if you're 99.144% black, then of course you're black, and if you're 1% black, of course you're black.
But I think that's the important thing that society needs to learn as a lesson. Your upbringing, your background, Charles and I are both black, yet Charles has a totally different upbringing than I do, and we kill around a lot, and sometimes we say to one another, damn, I'm more black than Charles is.
Right.
Yes, physically, Charles is more black than I am.
You see, so where
the shame does not match the reality.
Was that he physically was not black enough at that time for the white establishment. I was. I could visibly just sit there and then say, oh, well, they have a black.
That sounds
with Larry's presence, they would have to define his presence.
But that sounds like the cheapest form of tokenism. Now we're going to have Charles here because of his skin color.
It is the cheapest form of tokenism. But you also have to remember that whenever you think in a political movement, you try and expand your base. Therefore, when speaking to me, a white in a leadership position would sometimes treat me as a Chicano, as a white, and not as a black. Charles's skin color is a constant reminder that he's black, so it's different in dealing with Charles.
Yeah, well, I think also, with that, maybe initially that was the attempt, but whereas I tell Larry that he's blacker than I am, and I think initially whereas I might have been that comfortable token, I think after dealing with me, then I was not as much a comfortable token, because in a sense, I was dealing a little more white and looking black, whereas Larry was looking white and dealing more black.
Very confusing.
This sounds like roles that cops play when they stop somebody on the street.
But it's terrific that we found this brotherhood to work together. Also with the Chicanos being comfortable enough to see me go forth and speak for the Chicano issues.
Yeah.
And when the blacks are not there.
That's really been a beautiful thing.
It's been incredible.
Larry's fault is that his hair is straight. he would have no problem.
Yeah. Big lady with blue eyes, he's still got curly hair. Right? There's another aspect that I want to get in here just a little bit. But I am familiar with a phenomenon that Charles would relate to, but I'm not familiar with an equivalent that Larry might relate to, and that is the phenomenon of the committee system, the various committees around the country that hold conclaves and meetings, and black gay bourgeois, executive set, young business and professional men, have been gathering for some time in a kind of a black experience. Yeah. And in terms of personal liberation, in other words, how free is Charles Law, or how free is another person that attends that thing, and what kind of impact the conclave has on their freedom. Now that is objectively the movement, personal liberation, personal politics, and that's been going on in the gay community, or the black among black gay people, probably as long as the register and vote politics have been going on. Is there equivalent anywhere? And Charles, do you relate to that as a political experience?
Yes, in a sense. And formally, the whole committee idea has been going on about 10 years. The committee activities and, in a sense, our conclave, I think it represents somewhat of what I call an ambivalent redemption for Black gay people, because they can come to those affairs, and someone who may be a doctor, a lawyer, a CPA, a pharmacist, or whatever, in his city, he may go along and somewhat pass for straight and whatever, and be very closeted, somewhat uninvolved. They can go to a city with other friends from across the country who are gay, and you have a group of rather intelligent, refined, sophisticated gentlemen who just let their hair down. They go inside another place and they become screaming queens for a weekend, and you know, the biggest queers and fads in the world, and they enjoy it. It's a release. It's like Mecca, you know, and they leave there, and a lot of them still go back and dealing with that same pressure.
The voice drops and they get back into the executive wing, and there's right. The secretary bark time. Yeah. Is there anything that you can think of? Maybe Fiesta in San Antonio. That's a big Chicano event. Chicano influence on Fiesta's law.
Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras wouldn't have a Chicano input, but from the Chicano standpoint, I find more of an assimilation. I think that even here in Houston, one of the reasons why I became comfortable here real quickly is because minorities never had a chance to travel. So when I first came to Houston, I assumed that all Chicanos were Creoles, like myself, until they started speaking Spanish, which surprised the heck out of me.
A little different from Cajun French.
Yeah, extremely different. And that was 10 years ago. 10 years ago when I said, I don't speak Spanish, I was looked upon because I was a supervisor at a big department store. I was trying to be an elitist. When I came into the gay community at that time, 10 years ago, there was very little input from the Chicano community. You've got to realize in the Chicano family, just like a Creole or even a Black family, religion has a hard part to play in the lives of gays, and religion is oppressive. What has happened because of equal opportunities in educations is that minorities have been able to educate themselves and uplift themselves from this period of oppression. So you see a lot of Chicanos out there enjoying themselves in the bars. I hate to use that word assimilation because it's been used as such a negative word, but sometimes it's good. And what you see now is a cross-section of Chicanos and Blacks and even Vietnamese in the bars, in the organizations, in the religious organizations, in the political organizations, enjoying themselves and putting forth this type of activity. It's nothing like the Black community as far as the conclave. They tend to, this sort of thing tends to be a one-year type of thing. What we have in the Chicano community and in some of the Blacks that come out to the bars and into the organizations is around a year thing, mm-hmm. feeling comfortable. And I'm real proud of that, and I'm real comfortable with that because as a, what Ray Hill calls me, a half-breed, high 57, I think...
I'm just full of nasty lines.
I think one of the most positive things to come out of the gay community is that we can all respect each other's diversity. And when I look in a bar, I look at a group of people meeting and I see a little bit of everything, I'm real comfortable.
One final point. 10 years ago tonight, in New York City, a place called Christopher Street, the Stonewall Inn, if there ever was desegregation of the gay movement, it occurred there. We were talking about drag queens, we were talking about Black and Puerto Rican street people, talking about men and women that were just geographically reachable when the crisis was on. 10 years later, as people who are familiar with minorities, does Christopher Street mean anything to you?
Christopher Street means a lot to me because 10 years ago, I was going through a period of trying to... I just stepped out of the civil rights movement because I wasn't Black enough. And I was just beginning to experience the gay world. And in New Orleans, where raids went on constantly, I wasn't comfortable because that's not acceptable in my community. Especially being Creole, you had definitely gained white man's X if you became gay. So I experienced Christopher Street in 1969, the walk up the street, the Stonewall Inn, etc. And I was able to see the beginning of what was this diversity being recognized and unity and diversity. The only trouble was the people that were there, the drag queens, the leather people, the Puerto Ricans, etc., were not the type of people that I at that time were in tune with, having just come out of college, etc. I was looking more toward the executive type of what was going on. But to look at it back then, I have to praise these people that had the guts to put forth a movement that's given me the confidence I have today to say that I'm gay and I'm proud and I'm black and I'm proud and I'm brown and I'm proud. Because to step forth and say you're a human being and you're proud of being that human being and accept your diversity, I think is the first step toward freedom in general.
Charles, as one who is apparently on top of things in your own career and your own future, does that rabble on the street mean anything to you?
Yes, I think what it means to me, and I think in a large sense to the whole movement, 10 years ago, Christopher Street put forth an example for us of what is needed to attain liberation and freedom, the dignity the gay movement wants. That time in Christopher Street, those gay people there came together. All segments of the gay community, in terms of ethnic, in terms of social segments, in terms of gender, they came together and united for one common cause. It happened there, it worked, it was effective. However, we have failed to really view that, and in the 10 years following, there has still been the separation within the movement and trying to bring forth the same effort, but separated. The professional, the passing gay person, the leather people over here, the women over here, the blacks over here, the Chicanos over here, and so forth. And then having our separate, very distinct lines there, but yet trying to come together, but yet reminding people of our line. You know, we'll go together in line, but don't cross it. And it's not until we get rid of those lines and come together as they did, for one common cause, that we can effect what we want. So for 10 years, we've been trying to pull together the thing that happened there, perhaps out of spontaneity, in order to achieve that. And we'll have to see the lesson that was taught there, that in order for us to really become effective, it's going to require tearing down these walls, erasing these lines, and all of us coming together, blacks, Chicanos, whites, men, women, drag queens, leather people, bike people, very obvious people, the professional people, the street people, everybody coming together and accepting everybody for what they are.
Any hope? See any hope? Is that going to happen?
I think it's happening now. And one of the things I'm proud of is because I live in a city where it's really happening. You can go to the bars, you can go to the clubs, you can go around and see that this is happening because of organizations like the Houston Committee and the Gay Chicano Caucus and Integrity and GRS and so forth and so on. You can see blacks in all these organizations, you can see browns in there giving their input, and people are becoming comfortable with themselves.
But there's still discrimination.
There is discrimination, but it's not flaunted and it's not as open as it's been before.
But is it addressed?
I think it's addressed. I think it's addressed because before, you didn't have the Houston Committee. You didn't have the Gay Chicano Caucus. As I said in the beginning of the show, before you can deal with your gayness, you have to deal with your blackness or your brownness or your feminist as a woman, and then you can get into your gayness. Remember, we've been taught all our lives lies, not myths. I hate the word myth. You might like that, y'all. That's a little bit more intelligible. But I like the word lies.
Been lying on us.
Yeah, they've been lying on us for a long time. And we've just begun to realize those lies. And we're confronting these liars and saying these lies don't exist.
And they're from within as well as without, aren't they?
Yes, correct.
It's been Charles Law and Larry Bonner-Reitz, two very good friends of Wallenstein. And we're going to go back to the studio and continue our 12-hour broadcast. Happy Gay Pride Week.